Today on Main Street, we'll visit Madison, Wisconsin with our travel expert, Alicia Underly Nelson. We'll also hear what some states are doing to oppose cultivated meats, and Tom Ezern will explore the tradition of communal cattle herding on the Great Plains in his Plainsfolk essay number 1001. But first, on Main Street, we welcome Ruby Calvert. She's made public broadcasting her career. Now, she's the chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. She's also a longtime great friend of mine. Ruby, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Well, and thank you, Craig, for having me and inviting me to do this, because I think people are often confused about what's the difference between the public broadcasting system, PBS, NPR, National Public Radio, and CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. There's so much confusion between those entities, and so it's good to be able to have some time to talk about our differences and how we work together. So thank you for having me.
You're sure welcome. Ruby is now serving as the chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Ruby, let's start right there. What is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
Well, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting came out of the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, when Congress decided, you know, it really wanted to fund a public media system that would be include public television and public radio, but they wanted to be sure there was a firewall between Congress and the actual content and programming that would appear or be heard or seen on those two services. And so they created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with that act in 1967, and it composed of 9 board members, and they are, as you said, nominated by the President of the United States and then vetted by, you know, the FBI and other agencies, and then we actually are confirmed by the U.S. Senate, and it's a committee within the U.S. Senate, the Department of Commerce, and so you have interviews with the Department of Commerce committee members, and then after that, then it goes to the full U.S. Senate, and then you are voted on and confirmed. So it's a very long process, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, once you have your board, then it literally is the arm by which Congress designates and appropriates funding, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting then develops formulas and actually grants money to public television and public radio stations across the country. So there's and actually all the funding is kind of statutory, because we are, you know, prescribed to provide 5%, no more than 5% of the amount that's allocated to CPB. It goes to our administrative costs. 6% can be used for all station services, and I can explain that more, but basically it covers everything that could be used by all stations, like music rights, visual cue rights, like for if a station wants to use the cover of a book or a painting. CPB uses that station services money to pay for that kind of expense. And then 89% is distributed to public television and public radio stations by formulas. And so it's up to CPB to design those formulas so that they're fair and equitable to all stations.
And we here at Prairie Public are benefactors of that, Ruby. As you well know, we receive some of our funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and we, like many other public media systems, have other sources of funding too. But Ruby, I want to take you back a little bit. Why is public media so important?
Yeah, I've been in it for over 40 years now, which is hard to believe. But, you know, it has been a journey. And I think about my first glimpses of public broadcasting, 1969, because, you know, at that point I had a little boy, and somebody mentioned to me, have you seen the great children's program that you can see on Channel 6, Rocky Mountain PBS out of Denver? And I tuned in to Sesame Street and watched it with my son, and it was just, it was a game changer. And then, of course, then you start watching Masterpiece Theater, and Nova didn't come along for a few more years, but and you start watching more and more of it, and you realize what an educational resource and it is, and the local programming and content. And so that was my first experience with public media and public television, and I was so excited about it. So then when my husband and I moved to Riverton and found out they were going to be building a public television station here in Riverton in collaboration with Central Wyoming College, oh, I was so thrilled about it. I went up there and met with the person who was directing the grants and started working with him and for him. And then by the time the station was ready to go on the air, he asked me basically what I'd like to do. And we talked about programming, and I had been I was a graduate in English education. And so that was pretty exciting to me to be able to tell local stories. And so I said, well, why don't you just do programming and run production? I had no idea what a big job that would be. But, you know, the beauty of being at a small station is you learn every job. I mean, I cut promotional spots. I, you know, helped design events where we would bring in Big Bird for children. I went to the legislature, met with congressional leaders. At a small station, you have to do it all. Everybody had different hats, and we all shared them. And so you really, you grow up and you cut your teeth on public media, and you know what the breadth and scope is of public television. And, and at the time, we had a radio station, and we still do have a radio station at Central Wyoming College. It was not a public radio station, but I worked there, too. So I learned a lot about public radio, or at least operating a radio station. But, you know, and frankly, I just think there's nothing better than public television and public radio, and I'm committed.
Ruby, has that helped you or hindered you now that you are the chair of the CPB, which is now responsible for urban markets, rural markets for the entire country?
That's true. And I think it's given me a very deep perspective on what it takes to run a station. But, you know, it also makes me realize how interdependent we all are. I mean, at a small station, there's just no way you could fill your airtime with programs like Masterpiece Theater and Nova and the News Hour and Sesame Street and all the great shows you see in primetime on public TV. And so, you know, small stations rely on large markets to help get those programs produced. And so we are really interdependent, although, you know, there are many more urban and, or I should say, many more rural markets in our country. I mean, I think more than half of the stations in the country are classified as rural. So it's really an interdependent system, though, and I think it's been very helpful to be able to see both sides of it. So having worked at the local station and then being on the PBS board, where I met a lot of the general managers from the urban and medium and large market stations and heard about their issues, it's just you get a really broad perspective on the issues and challenges that we all face. But again, we all depend on each other, and that's both the beauty and the challenge, I think, for us as a system.
We are enjoying our conversation with Ruby Calvert, and she now serves as the chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Ruby, has the CPB changed in its tenure over time? Is it different today?
Craig, thank you for having me again. I think the mission maybe has not changed because that's prescribed by that Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. You know, if you look at it, there are 10 paragraphs, basically, with our mission sort of spelled out, and, you know, to provide educational and cultural and informational programming to serve to underserved audiences and the nation at large. And so that's really the basis of our mission, and that has not changed. But what has changed is the media environment, the way people watch and use television and radio. And so CPB has had to evolve the same way. And we're probably, you know, we'll be 60 years old in 2027. So in, you know, in 1969, 70, they were probably developing the formulas by which to pay the federal dollars out to public television, public radio stations. But today, you know, we're more concerned about how stations are managing their both their broadcast area as well as their online service. And, you know, and of course, in 1970, 72, 75, I mean, nobody even thought about the Internet and online distribution. And now that's really a big, huge part of what we're doing, how to transform stations to be ready for the digital world. And, you know, I wouldn't say that small stations are behind, but I think it's more of a challenge for small stations to be ready for the digital world and make the transformation. Large markets have a lot more people, and they're able to allocate people that are really looking at what they're doing, you know, looking at their Google Analytics or whatever it is to make sure that they're reaching more audience. And small stations are, you know, just not as ready. So that's a part of what CPB does, is to really look at the challenges out in the system and help all stations address those. But they have changed.
Ruby, we're going to talk about maybe the political pressure, the polarizing pressure that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has kind of endured here recently. But I want to ask you specifically, Ruby, why is public broadcasting still relevant and still important today as someone who is now the chair of the CPB?
Well, you're talking to someone who believes in it so deeply, mainly because of the importance, I think, for all of our communities and states. You know, if you look at the country at large, we have now, I think, 20 or maybe 25 stations that serve their entire state. But there are many stations that are community-owned stations or university-owned stations. And so it's really a kind of a strange marketplace in the way our stations operate, but we all have the same thing in mind, and that's serving our local community with important educational and cultural programming. And yes, we have been on the the firing line a number of times. I was reading one of my old columns from 2012 when that was a time when they were looking at chopping Sesame Street and a few other, I mean, that's what would happen, literally, if they cut the federal appropriation for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It would stop all the flow of funds to all public television and public radio stations from CPB. And again, for small stations, that's huge. I mean, because small stations, the federal appropriation through CPB might make up as much as 45% to 50% of their local budget. So whereas large markets have, you know, a much broader spread and more money, and so they're not quite as affected by the lack of federal dollars as small stations. And we've been able to prove that point over time, how important what we do is. Well, particularly on the local level, to fund historical programs that bring context, I mean, like public integrity project. And, you know, again, a lot of stations don't have the experienced editors who look at a story or listen to a story or watch a documentary in rough and say, oh, you forgot this perspective. This isn't balanced. This isn't objective. So what we did is we allocated money to train people to go to the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and for a year learn all about journalism integrity and objectivity. So we had one class that went through the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism, and then now we're in phase two, and we've got another cohort, and this time they're not going to that school, but they're going to the Poynter Institute. So I think there's an opportunity for small stations, rural, mid-market stations, even large markets, to have a refresher course on what it means to provide, you know, balance and journalistic integrity in the stories that you tell. And so I think that's really been an important initiative that CPB has been doing. And I want to continue in my tenure as chair. I just think that's very important. And, you know, we've got those same principles of integrity online, and we'll do more of that. So, yeah, I look at that as a real important thing that we do. One of our big challenges, Craig, along with the digital world, in our new technology, is developing a new interconnection system for public radio and public television. Our current contracts for interconnection will physically end in 2 years. And so we've got 2 years to develop a new interconnection system that will be by fiber. You know, currently, public radio, as you know, does its interconnection over satellite. And that's been the practice, well, forever. Public television had been using mostly satellite, but about 10 years ago, they started supplementing that with more internet distribution. And it works. And it could be cheaper and actually could inspire more collaboration between public television and public radio. And, and I think that's something we've got to work toward. And so we have 2 years to do it. And that is a really big objective in my tenure, is to get that started and to get everybody, you know, aligned with the mission and to get that done. And of course, you're with Prairie Public Television as a joint licensee, where you have both public radio and public television. You're going to be some of our first guinea pigs, as it were, to get our system off the ground and get buy-in from other joint licensees like Prairie Public, and I hope that other systems and stations will realize that this is the future, and we need to get there. And Congress expects us to be a good steward of their monies. And we do get a separate funding stream for interconnection. So we want to be sure that we do the right thing with that.
Ruby, what myths would you like to dispel that you encounter periodically that people across the country have about public broadcasting?
Well, one of the things, and I don't know that it's a huge myth or just a misunderstanding, is, you know, the different enterprises that we have, they're very confusing. You know, is PBS connected to NPR? What's NPR? Is CPB? Who's CPB? You know, I mean, I think people just don't understand that we operate sort of separately but together. And so NPR, National Public Radio, is, you know, a member organization. Prairie Public is a member of that, as is Wyoming Public Media here in Wyoming and most other public radio stations. There are many that are not members of NPR, and PBS, the public broadcasting system, which brings, you know, puts together the money to purchase the national programming and then distributes that to public television stations. So PBS is a different member organization. And then, of course, CPB, we receive the federal appropriation from Congress and distribute it directly to public radio and public television stations, who in turn support PBS and NPR. So, you know, that people are kind of, they misunderstand what those organizations are and do, and people still think that I'm on the PBS board, and I'm not. that's one of the strange things. But I think, you know, the other thing that you hear from some people today is, oh, you know, your news is slanted, or it leans left, or, you know, it's not balanced. But I, you know, if you go online and listen to stories, and if you do have concerns, you know, we have at CPB, we have a place where you can lodge your concerns, and they're all investigated, and we look at that specifically, you know, because we want balance, and we want people to, we want to dispel that myth that public media leans left or right. We want people to trust our programming, and it's just really important in the news we produce, the documentaries that we produce. I want the public trust. And, you know, for years, PBS did a survey and found that actually our nation's people really do trust the public broadcast system. They rank right up there with, you know, our other important entities. Like, well, I don't know if you can, I'd have to get out one of those trust surveys now, but it was right up there with the military and you know, the your local justice system. So I think we are a trusted resource. I think the big thing is that we don't have the dollars to promote what we do. You know, if you look at the amount of money that, like, a Motion Picture Association spends on, you know, promoting one of their newest movies, they spend as much in a promotion of a movie as we have in our programming budget for a year. So, you know, we don't have the promotion dollars to really have people tune in and see what's on our stations or listen to what's coming on public radio. So I think, you know, I wish we had more money to just promote what we do, because I think that's a big gap in our services.
We just have a couple of minutes left, Ruby, and I want to ask you, what do you hope your legacy will be as the chair of CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
Well, I hope people will say about me as the chair and our board is that we listened to stations and we tried to answer their concerns and that we tried to address them fairly and equitably, and that we were innovative, and that we made hard decisions when they had to be made, because I think, you know, as we look ahead, there are difficult decisions, and you don't know what will happen with the next Congress. I mean, we had, you know, a couple of bills that were filed to defund public broadcasting. I think that would be just a horrible eventuality. So I want my legacy to be that, you know, that we went to Congress, we proved that we're innovative, we're a good expenditure for Congress to make. We're doing, you know, we're doing education and civics education. And actually we're working on a project now to help young people learn all about jobs. It's called Jobs Explained, and it's online. And so far there have already been 9 million viewers of that. So I think the legacy for us is just to keep innovating, keep being a good steward of the federal appropriation, and listen to our public, our audience, our congressional leaders, and to have them understand that we want to serve this nation. You know, the people here who are underrepresented and underserved, we want to serve everybody. And that's just really important to me, to preserve the heritage and to be here in 20 years. So I hope I'm that link, Craig, and we can all look back on this time and say this was a turning point, but this was an important and productive turning point for CPB and for all stations.
Ruby Calvert, she previously served as general manager for Wyoming PBS and now serves as the chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. She hired me to work at Wyoming PBS and is a great longtime friend of mine. Ruby, it is great to hear from you. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Hey, Craig, thank you for having me. And I hope folks who are listening to this appreciate Prairie Public. I know a lot of people there, and you all do an amazing job. And I hope you'll keep up. I know you will keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig.
That's Ruby Calvert, now the chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Coming up, Tom Easern's Plains Folk essay, where he explores the tradition of communal cattle herding on the Northern Plains. Plus, our travel guide Alicia Underley-Nelson will take us to Madison, Wisconsin. And what about manufactured meat? That's all after this. In this week's Plains Folk essay, Tom Easern takes us on a journey through the history of cattle herding on the Northern Plains, inspired by a fascinating handbill he discovered in the Enderlin Museum. It's from 1897.
In the Enderlin Museum a few days ago, I noticed an old handbill on display, dating from 1897, and addressed to cattle owners. The undersigned hereby wishes to announce that he is again ready to receive orders for herding cattle during the coming season, from May 1st to October 1st, 1897. Good and sufficient drinking water can be found on the land. All cattle entrusted to my care will receive the best attention. All cattle must be branded. Price of herding, $1.50 per head. Signed, Charles Erbstesser, Watson County, Section 3, Maple River. Herr Erbstesser is offering to herd cattle for owners in Enderlin, although he lives on his farm just over across the line in southern Cass County. This all lines up with situations across the northern plains I have described previously, how people in towns commonly supplied themselves with fresh milk and cream by keeping a cow or two, how they released their cows after morning milking to join a town herd under the care of a herdsman who walked them out to pasture in the country, how the herdsman, known to the cows by his voice, easily gathered the beasts together in the morning and brought them home for evening milking, simply walking them up the alley from which they would turn of their own accord to return to their stalls. This is well documented in newspaper notices, but the handbill in Enderlin is the first I have seen. It is the more interesting because below the English language notice is a version in German. In fact, I think the English was translated from the German rather than vice versa. So, Mr. Erbstesser served both German and English-speaking townsfolk. Plus, I just like the way the German notice sounds. Gutes, gesundes Wasser und genügenden Schattenbäume. Jedes Stüdwe muss gebrennzeichnet sein. They all must be branded. When I posted this to social media, right away I heard from Alan Broge, who grew up German-Russian in South Dakota, attained some impressive academic credentials, and now works for the Pentagon at a job I figure I shouldn't ask too many questions about. He observed, "This was a strong tradition in many of the German colonies in Russia. They established a Hüttenkasse, herd fund, to which each colonist contributed according to the number of cattle that were taken out to pasture. The shepherds paid from this fund were usually Moldovans from the nearby villages." Now, Alan's people, as I recall, were Glückstalers, which would have put them in western present Ukraine, neighboring the Moldovans. So was our Mr. Erbstesser a German from Russia? Acquainted with the traditions in the Russian colonies? It turns out not. He was born in Saxony, Prussia, 1833, emigrated to Wisconsin, and came to Dakota Territory before 1880. But it is possible he knew about herding traditions in Saxony. In fact, what this inquiry teaches me is that such cooperative practices probably prevailed around the world. Witness this detail. I find a dispatch from a Peace Corps worker in present Moldova, who is delighted with her village neighbors' folkways in regard to their milk cows, how they give them over to a herdsman each morning for grazing in the country, and he brings them back for milking at evening. It all seems so familiar and winsome.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and has been a longtime contributor to Prairie Public with his Plainsfolk essays. That was essay number 1001.
The Fargo Public Library presents their Fall into Jazz concerts featuring local jazz artists Sundays, October 6th through the 27th, starting at 2 p.m. at the Downtown Main Library. More information at fargolibrary.org.
Periodically on Main Street, Alicia Underly Nelson joins us to talk about travel. Alicia, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be back.
You are in what I believe is one of the great cities in the Midwest. Tell us where you're at, Alicia.
I am coming to you right now from Capitol Square and the steps of the Capitol building in Madison, Wisconsin. A beautiful, artsy, farm-to-table dining kind of town. It's between two lakes, and it's sunny out. The water is glittering. People are out and about, dressed to the nines. It is a gorgeous fall day. I've never been to Madison before, and I have been so impressed with the time that we've spent here so far and cannot wait to see what happens tomorrow.
What do you think, Alicia, makes Madison different from other Midwest cities? I've had the opportunity to be there before. In fact, a company I worked for was headquartered there, and I got to experience it quite often. What do you think makes it different?
Well, I think it's a combination of things that all work together in harmony. So it's a college town, right? This is the home of the Badgers, and the campus is gorgeous right out by the water. And so the students are really integrated into the city, which I think really gives kind of a jolt of energy because everybody's questioning and learning and out and about and exploring. I've also seen some really great arts, talked to some really passionate chefs, very cool local shop owners. There's been a real resurgence here in the last, I've heard, 17, 15, 10 years, where people came back, you know, after the recession and even after the pandemic and really wanted to start something interesting and new. People that are coming back home to Wisconsin after spending time and getting new ideas and new places, people that are growing their Madison-based businesses, and people that are coming here from larger cities all over the world that want a place that's a little bit more, I don't know, you kind of have a smaller city feeling with all the amenities that you're used to in a larger city. And people, I don't know, it's really connected to nature here, which is great. People are out on the water a lot. People are, it's a platinum-rated biking city, an excellent city for walking. So you can just get a hotel room or, you know, choose a neighborhood to explore and go out and find great shops, great restaurants, great cafes and coffee shops. And that, I think, is really what I'm attracted to when I'm doing urban travel. Is I like that you don't have to work too hard to plan. You don't have to think about how to get from one place to another. You can just pick a point on the map, know you're in a good neighborhood, and trust the city to deliver you something excellent. And if you ever get stuck, this is a great town. You ask your barista, you ask the bartender, you ask your server, where should I go? What should I check out? And there's so much great food in this city, so many great shops, and a lot of really wonderful street festivals. And that, I think, makes the city feel really lively and really engaged. And you don't really have to have a plan in Madison. You just pick a good place to start and let the day unfold. It's the best vacation in my book.
You talked about the University of Wisconsin being an anchor for Madison. I think that that university has more impact on Madison than any other community that I've been to that is also home of a major university, especially when you're outside recreating. Do you agree with that?
You know, I think that's definitely true. I've seen a lot of students. I've seen faculty around. I've seen a lot of Badger shirts. I've seen a lot of people moving freely. And I think it really helps that the most famous street is State Street, which connects downtown to campus. And it's a major thoroughfare. It's closed to cars, you know, later in the afternoon and the evening, so people are out and about walking. And it just makes it easy to exchange, you know, people exchange, idea exchange, like it's easy to get around. And when you're here between the lakes, it just, yeah, it's fun to get out and walk and bike and to connect with your neighbors. And yeah, I see a ton of presence of the university, both on the street and then conversations with people in a really organic way. And I mean, I live in Fargo, right? Fargo's a college town too, but I don't know. It's a little bit different here. There's a lot of Badger pride, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think that its proximity to so much of what is accessible to tourists makes a big difference if you're out at a restaurant, if you're out having a beer, if you're out having a coffee. Many of the great places to do that, right next to campus, where there are just, you mentioned it's a platinum bike community. It is. There are bikes everywhere. Even in winter, they do a great job of keeping bike paths open and people are out and about biking. Alicia, you talked about the lakes, and I can't impress upon people enough, and I want you to try it because you're the expert, of how important the lakes are to the Madison community.
Oh, they're vital. The indigenous people that lived here for thousands of years, this was a community of four lakes. And I think when you think of modern Madison, you think of the two main lakes, so Lake Monona, which is glittering and beautiful in the morning, and I just spent a little time there, hung out on the Frank Lloyd Wright Design Plaza, had some coffee, and that's been, you know, populated for millennia. It's been a popular resort destination. It's brought people to the water's edge for years and years. I mean, it's a vital part of the city. And then on the other side, you have Lake Mendota. So that's kind of more your evening, you know, you get the sunset coming over that direction. And people are out on the water constantly. I saw boats out this morning. They just recently stopped their rentals. You can go out and paddle boat and canoe and kayak, you know, well into the fall. People are out along the waterfront. I sat at my hotel this morning and listened to people talking about running and walking and jogging along the river. So people are out. They're active, and it's great. It seems like if you're in downtown or if you're on campus, you almost always have the water within sight. And if you turn around and look in another direction, you'll see the granite dome of the state capitol. So it's a really beautiful skyline, but it's also really connected to nature. There's a lot of great trees and some green park areas, and everything's turning beautiful fall colors right now. So it definitely feels like a place. Yes, it's urban, but it's a place that you can sit, you can relax. It's meant for strolling. And that's really been happening every hour of the day. So right now it's the afternoon. People are out with strollers and dogs. And then it gets a little bit later. The sun starts to go down. Everybody's dressed to the nines and checking out all the different restaurants in all the neighborhoods. And we're actually excited to go a little bit deeper into the East Side neighborhoods tomorrow and learn a little bit more about the shops, find some. I love vintage shops and resale. I love local makers and artists. So I'm really looking forward to digging into that side as well. And I'm gonna need to do some more walking because I've eaten so much great food. I will never need to eat again. I think I probably inhaled 7,000 calories by lunch today. It's a hard job, but somebody's got to do it.
And you do a great job of it, Alicia. Alicia Underlee Nelson. She joins us periodically to talk about travel here on Main Street. Alicia, I'm not sure if you're going to get to go by Camp Randall Stadium. Have you been over there yet?
We are actually doing that later today. There's a gentleman riding and ringing his bell, going on his bike right, taking that direction right now. So we're going to walk down State Street. We're going to head to have some ice cream at the Memorial Union, which is going to be fun. And then, yeah, check out the stadium. My husband is a huge college sports fan, so it's been very fun for us to see not only some of the athletes from the school here, but there's also a big track meet in town. So we've been meeting athletes from all over the U.S. and everybody's just out and about walking. And I think there's something about the energy on a college campus too. I think sometimes when people travel, they think, oh, I don't go to school there. I can't go there. But what's really nice about this particular university is that UW is really open. And it's kind of about that exchange, and they invite people in, and it shows up in their tourism brochures. They're like, yeah, come check it out. It makes us unique. So I think you need to trust the tourism people. When they say it's worth going to, go explore and just kind of be part of that energy, be part of that atmosphere, right? Because there's just, I don't know, colleges do energy better than almost any other community on earth.
When I visited Madison, I always went on business, or I had my wife join me, or we came to visit a gal that used to work for us who went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison in her undergraduate days, but we never brought our family. What's Madison have to offer for families, Alicia?
Oh, so much. It's a great place to hang out. My husband and my son and my nephew just checked out the zoo. It's a free zoo, one of the few free zoos in the country. So they were sending me photos and doing a little second shooting and a little reporting for me, telling me all about the amazing animals there. So that's an absolute blast. Definitely get out on the water whenever you can. The ice cream game in town is super strong, so we're definitely going to the UW Babcock Dairy at the Daily Scoop, and they have a thing there called the Freshman 15, where you can get 15 scoops of ice cream. I think that's hilarious. Bring the
family.
I've
never heard the Freshman 15 described
that
way.
Funny?
That's really funny.
I know. We've been eating our way through all the ice cream, and we're actually headed out tonight. We're going to a fall fest at the Aldo Leopold Nature Center. Lots of great, easy ways to get outdoors, kind of get out in nature, do some not-so-spooky things for families, and their fall calendar is absolutely packed with things to do. And we are very excited to check out the Dane County Farmers Market. It's a Saturday and Wednesday tradition here in Madison, and over 150 vendors attend every Saturday. It's absolutely huge. It is the largest producers-only farmers market in the country, and you may think, like, why would kids like that? Why do kids want to go get produce? But it's great because there's pastries and breakfast and snacks, and you can sample all the great cheese. I mean, some of the best cheese on the planet is made within 45 minutes of where I sit right now in Madison. So you get all this amazing food. And we just actually went to the last night market of the year yesterday with a very similar vibe. And people were having cotton candy on these light up sticks. There was xylophone music. There was hands-on fun science experiments. People were creating art out and about. It's just a fun place to go and hang out. I think kids really respond to novelty, and kids respond to energy. And kids are a lot more game than we think they are. I think so much of the time parents will say, well, I have to take them to something that's made for kids. But really what kids love is they love color, and they love life, and they love energy, and they love music, and they love being able to run around. And so many of the great events here in Madison are outdoors. So you don't have to really worry about the kids getting in at anything crazy. It's fun. There's plenty to see. And then we're actually going to check out the really wonderful Madison Children's Museum as well. So that's kind of geared for newborn through age 12. But I have a secret. I kind of like children's museums even as a grown-up. So there's always something a little fun to engage in. And I like museums that any kind of museum, even if it's an art museum or a history museum, that doesn't take itself too seriously. And I think, you know, take the kids out, take them where you enjoy going, and they'll enjoy it too. And so many museums across the country are getting so wonderful about finding new and interesting ways to engage kids. But there's a lot here that is geared toward kids in Madison, and a lot of fun outdoor community activities. Just make it easy to be a family and to see what happens. You know, stroll around, get some chocolate, sample some cheese, find some ice cream, have something fun to drink. We found some good apple cider donuts, and it's kind of that prime time for warm cider and cocoa and donuts and all those yummy fall flavors. And the food here in Madison is great. Even if you don't consider yourself a foodie, take yourself out for a special dinner or a great lunch. You're going to be so impressed.
And you don't have to walk far. Alicia, where else are we going to visit with you on your travels this fall and early winter?
I'm doing a lot in South Dakota, so I'll be in Sioux Falls, and I'll also be doing some interesting antiquing and coffee shops in Valley City. And then I hope to be heading out to Germany, Austria, and Switzerland later this winter.
The life of a travel writer, Alicia Underlee-Nelson. She joins us periodically here on Main Street. Safe travels, Alicia.
Thank you so much.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative, and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with over 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Cultivated meat, a product grown from animal cells in a lab, is gaining traction but faces strong opposition from some U.S. states, including Nebraska. Nebraska's governor and others are backing restrictions and bans on its sale and labeling, citing threats to traditional livestock industries, as we'll hear in this report from Harvest Public Media.
Here, in the test kitchen for good meat in Alameda, California, they're frying chicken.
As I said, I like to get it a little crispy on the edges there.
Joshua Hyman is the company's sales and marketing chief. He's demonstrating Good Meat's cultivated meat product. It's part plant-based meat substitute and part chicken meat that's grown from chicken cells outside a chicken's body in a bioreactor.
Well, it's really simple. You just cook it like you would cook any normal piece of conventional chicken.
Good Meat is one of two cultivated meat products approved for sale back in 2023 by the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Cultivated meat is still years away from a mass market, but Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen sees it as a threat to livestock producers.
Fake meat, petri dish meat, lab-grown meat, bioreactors, to just sit back and hope that doesn't happen, hope's not a very good strategic decision.
Governor Pillen, whose family owns Nebraska's largest pork-producing operation, ordered restrictions on the sale and labeling of cultivated meat in his state, and he's backing legislation to ban it altogether.
The bottom line is if a Nebraskan wants to eat the stuff, good for them. They're just not going to buy it in Nebraska.
Nebraska isn't alone. Earlier this year, Florida and Alabama passed bans on cultivated meat, while Iowa passed restrictions on its sale and labeling. And bans have been proposed in at least six other states, including Illinois and Kentucky. Josh Tetrick, Good Meat's CEO and co-founder, calls it political calculus. He says in some states, they're trying to make cultivated meat a wedge issue.
Not ideal that it's become sort of a cultural thing in those states. But my hope is, as is usually the case, if you make something that most Americans and consumers really want to buy, they'll do it, and the politicians will adjust.
The National Cattlemen's Beef Association, which represents cattle farmers and ranchers, says consumers will choose traditional beef. Director of Government Affairs Sigrid Johannes says that's if the packaging makes it clear which is which. The association wants a federal labeling law, which would mark cultivated meat as imitation.
Our perspective is give people all the information, make sure that it's very clear so that they can make a choice when they go to purchase their groceries for the week.
Proponents of cultivated meat say it's got a smaller carbon footprint than meat from the farm and doesn't require the slaughter of animals. And some experts believe it will be needed to supplement meat that comes from livestock as global demand increases. Professor Thomas Hawk studies cultivated meat technology at McMaster University in Hamilton, Canada. He says eventually cultivated meat could be cheaper than meat that comes from a farm.
So the idea is if you can afford to purchase meat that's raised in the traditional way, and that's your choice, that's great. If you can't, this is an alternative for you.
As efforts to ban cultivated meat heat up in the U.S., the matter may be decided in the courts. Upside Foods, the other company with federal approval to sell cultivated meat, has filed a lawsuit against the Florida ban. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jim Meadows.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 22nd. As World War I raged, urgent pleas for help came from Jews in Eastern Europe. They were suffering not only from food shortages, but also from discrimination and oppression. An estimated 2 million Jews were entirely dependent on charity. In response, the Orthodox Union in the United States established a relief committee in 1914. When fundraising efforts fell short, they asked President Wilson to designate Jewish War Relief Day. Wilson approved the measure in 1916, noting in his proclamation that Americans have learned with sorrow of this terrible plight of millions of human beings and have most generously responded to the cry for help whenever such an appeal has reached them. Jewish Relief Day became an annual event, and Wilson's confidence in the generosity of Americans was not misplaced. Americans opened their hearts to the plight of Eastern European Jews. On this date, in 1918, the Bismarck Tribune reminded readers that the following day was National Hebrew Relief Day. The federal government, as well as every state government, was participating in the effort. Governor Frazier's proclamation noted that Jewish Americans had fully supported the war effort and that North Dakotans can best show our appreciation of their efforts by helping to alleviate the suffering of those of their race in this, their hour of direst need. The committee in Bismarck, headed by businessman Alex Rosen, set a goal of $5,000. Although the flu epidemic would limit large fundraising activities, people were reminded that they could mail in donations. Bismarck residents proved to be generous, raising $750 before the fundraising effort was officially open. It is estimated that 10 million military personnel from more than two dozen countries were killed during the war, and an additional 23 million military personnel were wounded, many suffering horrific injuries. While the United States mourned the 117,000 military personnel who would never come home and those grievously injured, Americans were also aware that an estimated 11 million civilians had been killed during the war, and those who remained were suffering. North Dakotans stepped up to provide aid for the victims as the war wound down, and their response to Hebrew Relief Day was gratifying. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street. We are so grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll host a live debate about Measure 4. It's a tax proposition that, if passed, would eliminate property taxes in North Dakota. Are there ramifications? Former legislator Dr. Rick Becker and Aaron Burst, executive director of the North Dakota Association of Counties, will join me for a live give-and-take debate. That's tomorrow, right here on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.